Today in Studio 360, you know what Tolstoy said? That every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way?
It's a memoir. The story of everything that happened to us.
Oh, I see. You want us to brace ourselves.
A compellingly unhappy family is the subject of the best new play I've seen in ages, Other Desert Cities by John Robin Bates. It's about powerful Republican parents and their wobbly, unrepublican kids. And national politics gets the fictional treatment in O, the buzzy Obama novel written by Anonymous. John Heilemann, the co-author of Game Change, has a pretty good hunch about who he thinks Anonymous is.
You know, I don't think that you come away thinking that this book is a love letter to Barack Obama. So I'm going to float the theory right now that this book was written by...
You're unbelievable.
Families and politics, real and make-believe. That's all ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, I'll talk with the playwright John Robin Bates about his fabulous new play, Other Desert Cities. And later, we'll hear about the mother of all modern kitchens.
Almost everything we know about kitchens today comes from the Frankfurt Kitchen.
But first...
My guest today is presidential nominee, Governor Jack Stanton.
I'm going to do something really outrageous. I'm going to tell the truth.
A hairdresser has come forward, alleging a long-term affair with the married candidate.
15 years ago this month, a novel was published that created a sensation. It was a thinly veiled chronicle of Bill Clinton and his successful presidential campaign called Primary Colors. And it was written by Anonymous. Nobody knew at the time. It became a big bestseller and eventually a movie starring John Travolta. Now, as if on cue, there is another anonymously written novel out this week speculating about the 2012 election. This one is just as coy. It's called O, and the cover has a caricature of President Obama's ears. John Heilemann is the co-author of a great book, a nonfiction book, about the 2008 election called Game Change that he wrote with Mark Halperin. John Heilemann, welcome to Studio 360.
Kurt, it is a pleasure to be here.
You spend a lot of time talking to the principals in the political establishment in Washington, to the people in the White House. Are people down there talking about this?
Yes. In a word, the answer to that question would be no. And in fact, it's been funny to read the publicity and the stories that have been written about this because, of course, the conceit of all of them is Washington is abuzz with conversation about who wrote O. I spent a lot of time in the West Wing in the early part of January, and I can tell you that not a single person asked me who I thought had written it. There's no speculation and there's no buzz as far as I can see in Washington, D.C., except among people who perhaps are way, way, way underemployed.
But you actually have a theory about who the writer is.
I do, developed just recently, I will say. First of all, I mean, I have no actual knowledge of who wrote the book, and this is not a reported fact. I have an intuition, and it's based largely on a tiny little shard of evidence, which is the beginning of the book. There's a story that's recounted about one of the main characters in the book, a guy named Cal, who is an aide to President Obama.
Manages his campaign.
Yeah. Correct, manages his campaign. And it talks about how before he was recruited, he was being recruited to work for his rival, the front runner, who is the Hillary Clinton stand-in, ostensibly here. And he talks, the story that's told on page two, just in brief, he says, you know, no formal offer had been made at the last meeting. I'm quoting from the book. But a week later, a chair had arrived at his office, an inexpensive oak-veneered Windsor reproduction with a note signed by the candidate, quote, there's a seat for you at our table. And as it happens, that actually occurred in real life. A senior strategist in the McCain campaign had that experience with a different candidate who was trying to recruit this person to work for them. And it's not something that's very well known. It's never been reported anywhere, which suggests to me that it's someone who knows this particular senior strategist very well. there aren't that many people in politics who could write a novel at any length. And so that, so if you think about people who worked on the McCain campaign and who could possibly write a novel, you're down to just a couple of people. And then you think about the fact that this book's publisher is a gentleman named Jonathan Karp, who also happened to publish all of John McCain's books, which were all ghostwritten by a gentleman named Mark Salter. So I'm going to float the theory right now that this book was written by Mark Salter.
I mean, there is this entirely fictional, doesn't exist anywhere in the real life horizon, a Republican candidate who runs against Obama in 2012, who was a military hero and then ran a company and is this super independent guy who is neither captured by the Tea Party or anybody else. And as you said, who does that sound like?
Well, it sounds an awful lot like John McCain with a little bit of Mitt Romney floated in there without any of the downsides of either one of them. And again, that would point pretty straight to Mr. Salter.
And somebody, by the way, who really doesn't like Arianna Huffington, who is one of the few very specific caricatured characters in this book.
Yes, I'm pretty sure that this person does not write for the Huffington Post, nor any of its any publications that are sympathetic to the Huffington Post.
One of the things that surprised me about this novel is how little it seems to get at who Barack Obama is and what it's really like in the White House. It seems all about an election campaign, which, again, would conform with your theory of who wrote it. It doesn't purport to give any new, shocking, interesting, fictionally amazing insight into Barack Obama.
No, and you know, I think that there's a, you know, the big giveaway here, and I'm not the first to mention this, is the notion that the book is being promoted as being written by someone who has been in the room with Barack Obama. No one has really revealed how big that room was, and you know,
I've been in the room with Barack Obama.
Yes, you have, probably inside of like Madison Square Garden. Part of the reason why previous efforts of this kind, like Primary Colors, worked so well,
the Joe Klein novel,
the Joe Klein, the anonymous first, and then Joe Klein novel, was that there was a level of insight into the principals and into the staff members, the key people around him, the George Stephanopoulos-like character, the James Carville-like character, that were written from the eye of someone who really knew those characters extraordinarily well and could capture them not just well, but in a way better than they could in their magazine journalism. They could cut to a deeper truth about those people that only fiction can really provide.
It strikes me as something written as a novel, published as a novel, that really feels more like a kind of collection of conventional wisdom nonfiction book about a political election, whereas interestingly, your book Game Change was sort of the converse, a nonfiction book about the 2008 election, criticized by some people for being written just like a novel.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I'll tell you that before Game Change was a twinkle in our eyes, I was thinking about, man, somebody should be making a movie out of this. And then from there, I'm not in the movie making business, but maybe there's a way to do a book. And my next thought was, maybe could somebody do a Primary Colors of the 2008 campaign? And then that passed quickly into, I'm not really a novelist either, so let's think about, you know, how to do a nonfiction account that has all of the qualities of a novel.
Clearly, this book is trying to take advantage of the Primary Colors marketing success. Do you think it might do that despite what you and I agree are its lesser literary qualities?
I don't really, and I think, you know, partly it's hard to play the same charade, right? I mean, because people see it for what it is, and the other thing it's obviously trying to do is it's trying to capitalize on what has been one of the fundamental verities of the first 2 years of the Obama administration, which is that O sells. You know, when it put him on a cover of a magazine, put him on the cover of picture books, kids books, any kind, you know, he's been a marketable commodity. And you can see why a publisher would say, hey, you know, maybe I can take this formula and give it a little bit of a twist and combine it with Obama and we'll get pure gold. Time will tell, as we say in the business about that, but I have my doubts.
John Heilemann writes about politics for New York Magazine. Since John and I talked earlier this week, his Game Change co-author, Mark Halperin, says that he has confirmed Heilemann's hunch about Mark Salter. We have been living for a while now in this relentless 24/7 news cycle, and everybody complains about it, but nobody does anything about it. Except maybe our resident folk singer, Scott Blazek.
When I was feeling scared and overwhelmed, the news cycle, it beat me down. End of the world every night, gave me hives, sick with fright. And talking heads, shut your mouths. Then a wise old man from the MIT said the meteor slanted. See, conglomerates, they got their scheme straight news. It's a pipe dream. He said two words, media bias. So I squinted at my TV set and cable news. It's all wet, PBS and C-SPAN too. You take their word, you're a goddamn fool. Not me, no sir. And canceled my dish. Turns out it's worse than I knew. Magazine, newspaper, internet too. Radio, books, government docs. I found that bias on the back of my cereal box. I'm a silly rabbit. Gets them when they're young. Well, I piled them lies up on my porch. I cursed them all and I lit the torch. To me, the only source that ain't queer is the guy that stares back in the mirror. I ain't trusting no trend stories, Gallup polls, press releases, road signs. I ain't falling for that global warming, vaccinations, economics, freakonomics, astronomy, gravity, New Jersey. They came over one night, said I wasn't quite acting right. They called me paranoid and whacked. I boxed their ears and I snuck out the back. I feel sorry for them, brainwashed fellers. So I got me a place up high in the hills, cut off good from the modern frills. Just my thoughts ain't nothing else when I realized might be biased against myself. Oh no, good God, how do you fact check your own brain? I don't even trust this song. I better stop.
Studio 360's Scott Blazek with Talkin' Media Bias Blues, which he wrote and performed. You can hear more of Scott's original songs at studio360.org. And while you're at the website, you can also sign up for the podcast of Studio 360 so you never, ever have to miss an episode. For my money, dialogue doesn't get much better than that written by John Robin Bates.
And we had to promise no wine when we took Justin out of rehab.
Out of where?
Oh.
He created the ABC drama Brothers and Sisters, about a grown-up family of smart, strong personalities who fight a lot.
That's nothing to be embarrassed of.
Oh, but homosexuality is.
Oh, Kevin, you know, please, enough. Can you just please tell him that you have a gay brother, too?
Who's gay?
Thanks, kid. That would be me, Grandma. I'm gay.
You're not gay.
Robbie Bates has a new play that's all that and then some, and it's the best new play I've seen in a long time. It's called Other Desert Cities, and it's about a prominent Southern California Republican family whose novelist daughter comes home for Christmas with the manuscript of a new book, which is great until she reveals that it's a memoir filled with very dirty laundry.
A memoir of?
Us. The story of everything that happened to us. So I wanted to prepare you for this.
Oh, I see. You want us to brace ourselves. Which is why you were so hesitant to tell us earlier. You thought we couldn't handle it.
I needed to finish writing it to be sure and to know what I had, to sit with it.
Well, it's not entirely unexpected. May I ask what's in it?
Actually, probably the more piquant question is what's not. Isn't it, Brooke?
That's Stockard Channing and Stacey Keach playing the parents and Elizabeth Marvel playing their daughter, Brooke. Robbie Bates draws you in with really funny characters and then takes you to some darker, much darker, more emotional places.
I love this thing of trying to be disarmingly funny in a very old-fashioned kind of way for a long time and then turning it upside down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you do beautifully. They drink a lot. They're articulate. They are funny, but also disturbing. There's a powerful wife and a passive husband, a missing child. What was I reminded of, but Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I didn't even think of that until right now. But I think in some ways my father was somewhat recessive and my mother was somewhat kind of a force of nature. And I have an older brother who I had been very close to, but by the time I started living abroad with my folks, he was already at college. He was at Georgetown, and we were in Durban, South Africa.
And this is during apartheid and troubles. And
yeah, so he didn't have that same experience that I did there, and I could have used him. So he in some ways, you know, we have a running joke, my brother and I. He's a composer, and we have a running joke when he gets a new play of mine. He says, well, do I die in this one?
Has he seen this one?
He's read it.
He knows the answer.
Yes.
I want to play another scene from Other Desert Cities. This is Polly, again, Stockard Channing, talking with her lefty, New York-y, recovering alcoholic sister, played also brilliantly by Linda Lavin.
See, your politics offend normal people. You goad people with them.
I like to spar.
That's what Attila the Hun said. That's why you two are so isolated around here. Your only social life is with the blue hair Republican crowd. Jesus, all those fundraisers you do or go to, those hopeless squares. You used to be so with it when we were kids.
Zilda, I love those fundraisers. I believe in them. I believe in that crowd. Those are my people. They still have a stake in upholding the entrepreneurial American spirit. I'm still a Texas girl, Zilda, and so are you.
Honey, newsflash. You're not a Texan. You're a Jew! We're Jewish girls who lost our accent along the way, but that wasn't enough for you. You had to become a goy, too.
Linda Lavin and Stockard Channing in Other Desert Cities by John Robin Bates. When you're writing, does Finnish snappy, jokey dialogue like that just come right out, or do you develop it as once you're working with the actors?
The core is there. Like, I hear their voices, I see them, I know what they look like. What changes is plot. You know, I'm very bad at plot, and I eventually, through working with Joe Mantello, the director, you know, I attach actual event instead of just sort of putting the earrings of incident on.
Was there, as you were working to get the plot right, were there any outstanding challenges that you felt like, does that really work?
Everything is a challenge. It's a year of draft after draft of, what's that word? I'm forgetting that terrible word because I'm so bad at it. When you parse out the necessary information in a scene.
Exposition?
I had a block against it because I'm so frightened of it. Sat here, she heard psychology at work. And Joe was very, very insistent that I keep working on keeping the secret alive.
Your director, yeah.
Yeah, my director and ex.
Yes.
Yes. And
there's a play to write someday, right? Working with your ex as your director?
It's so great because there's nothing but the sort of insistence that it be great. He gives no quarter. I mean,
he can call your BS probably better than somebody with whom you weren't romantically involved.
Absolutely. Yeah. He has no illusions and great, great, great respect, more respect for me than I have for myself. And that demands a kind of brutality at times, which I found very bracing.
You grew up in South Africa, as you say, Durban, South Africa, went to a boys' school there, a white school during apartheid. What was that like for you? And has it affected who you are?
It's completely affected who I am. I'm this American kid who at age 10 goes to South Africa. I'm sort of a consummate outsider by the time I'm 11. And there I am with these sort of, you know, kids from, you know, the Peter Brook version of Lord of the Flies. And, you know, I'm running around.
Are you Piggy?
I think I'm Piggy at that point. And at the same time, I'm weirded out by a teenager's version of feeling complicit in something that you're not supposed to be part of. I think I idealize.
Complicit in apartheid?
Yes, yeah. And sort of integration into the culture of enslavement and privilege. And but one thing I did learn there, you don't know what you are at all until something's happened to prove the thing you are. Like, you know, I was really comfortable down there living that way. And I watched all of us being really comfortable. And so now when people say I'd never name names, I say, you want to bet? And that's my basic position. It's not, you know, Calvinistic. because that would be punishing about it. But it says...
Until you're put in the position.
Yeah, you bet.
Have you been back to South Africa?
Once, during the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, briefly. I was terrified. I was just terrified.
Of what?
Well, there were fires everywhere. There was car crashes. Like, I found out that something like 20% of the kids I knew from elementary school there had died in car crashes. I mean, the country seemed to be in a period of post-revolutionary implosion.
They had a peaceful change of regime, which we all gloried in, but you're saying it had it in a whack-a-mole way came out elsewhere.
Yeah, and you know what was so remarkable, I went to some of the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, spent an afternoon there, and it seemed brilliant theater, brilliant, brilliantly conceived theater, a show trial of sorts for the nation.
Last time you were on the show, we were in Los Angeles, and you were working on the TV show Brothers and Sisters, which you created. Did writing for television have an effect on you as a writer for the stage?
Yeah, it made me want to come back to the stage.
Really, as a temperamental way to work, that wasn't your cup of tea?
Oh, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. I mean, just the fact that I came from New York and wrote sort of serious-ish plays— before I opened my mouth, there was a kind of trope going around the studio, the network already. Like, we can't have any of that Batesian angst. I would get that note before I'd written a word.
Okay. Which, of course, is why what they loved about you, and as soon as you're there, what they hate about you.
Yeah, it was like that Barton Fink feeling. And you'd have to pitch the episode to the network. And so I'd say, and then there's a confrontation in the kitchen between Sally Field and Calista Flockhart, and everything comes out. And there would be a beat, and it's all over the phone, and they go, everything comes out, but not in an angsty way.
And it ended really badly, right? They basically kicked you out.
Oh, it was I helped kick myself out.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, it's not funny. Maybe it's funny, but you're so not a person bristling with rage as many writers who have these experiences are.
I was so heartbroken about not being able to do the TV show the way I wanted to do it, and I was so completely incapacitated by that battle that I forgot how to be.
Yeah.
And I came back here and I went out, I had a little cottage out in East Long Island, and I sat there for literally a year and a half just thinking. I just thought. I started to teach myself how to write a play again.
And the result was this, the new play, Other Desert Cities. Now, this play is all about parenthood. You don't have children, right?
I don't.
Because you seem to get the nature of parenthood entirely. Polly talks at one point about being a parent being indentured servitude. And I'm wondering if you thought about the practical limits to what parents ought to do for their kids.
Absolutely. I mean, as you get older, if you're sane, you start to feel like you become them in so many different respects. You move like them. And yet at the same time, you don't leave your fundamental nature behind. You are this other thing. And I've watched in my own parents the point where their being parents is secondary to their innate nature, which comes first, finally, at the end of the day. And I feel great sympathy, if not empathy, for that.
At the heart of this play, it seems to me, is the unconditional nature of parental love and what one does on behalf of that.
I really do feel that. I've come to deeply love them, my parents. As you shed the sort of anecdotes of misbehavior from all sides, what you're left with is really, it's so sentimental, but it's so true, the good stuff for me, the human stuff, the forgivable stuff.
Yes. Robbie Bates, thank you very much for this play and coming in today.
Oh, gee, thanks.
The play Other Desert Cities by John Robin Bates is at the Lincoln Center Theater in New York right now. And if you're in New York or live in New York, you should go see it. Coming up, the modern American family comes in all kinds of flavors in real life, and now on the screen.
Look, I only met him once.
Who did you meet once?
Paul.
Who's Paul?
Our sperm donor.
The kids are all right, the first great movie about the two-mom family. It's up for an Oscar, and I'll talk with the director, Lisa Cholodenko. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. One of the movies nominated for an Academy Award this week was The Kids Are All Right. It stars Annette Bening, Julianne Moore, and Mark Ruffalo. The Kids Are All Right is a big Hollywood film about lesbian parents, and it's been very commercially successful, probably because it's about two women struggling with issues that a lot of old married couples face. That's when their teenaged kids decide to look up their biological father, played by Mark Ruffalo.
So, Paul, did you always know that you wanted to be in the food services industry?
I always liked food.
No, I was asking because I remember when I was reading your file back when we were looking for, sperm.
Not a potato salad.
Sure. Anyway, you said that you were studying international relations.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That was a long time ago. I was considering it, but then I dropped out of school.
Oh. You dropped out of college?
Yeah, it just wasn't my thing.
No, huh? Why's that?
I don't know, it just seemed like a massive waste of money after a while. You know, I was just sitting on my ass listening to people spout ideas I could just as easily have learned in a book.
Oh.
That's from The Kids Are All Right, starring Annette Bening, Julianne Moore, and Mark Ruffalo, which is now an Oscar-nominated movie. The film was co-written and directed by Lisa Cholodenko, and I talked to her when the movie was just out. So your first film, High Art, was this movie about a steamy love affair between two women that a few hundred thousand people saw in theaters. This movie, The Kids Are All Right, has these big stars that millions of people will see in the theaters. Was making a movie like this for a wider audience, is that something that you're inspired to do?
This is the first film that I've done with a co-writer. I wrote it with Stuart Blumberg. And part of what the calculation was for Stuart and I was let's take this theme that could really be like a marginal theme and, super art house and open it up to be as universal and as accessible as we possibly can and take all the things that are, potentially rarefied and super subversive. And let's make a mainstream film out of
this. Which you've done. And having just had a daughter go off to college, as millions of parents no doubt just have, they'll all cry too when the daughter in this film goes off to college. It is entirely accessible. And even though it's about this transgressive subject.
Yeah. Well, I think in the end we both felt, wow, that is a really unifying principle. That's really where this family, feels in the most genuine and soulful way.
Like a family and like any family.
Yeah, and like that's the only family they want, in that goodbye circle. That's their kin.
To the degree, though, that it is about gay parents, how do you feel that how lesbians have been depicted in the pop culture?
Well, I don't think there's been much depiction to talk about.
Yeah,
I mean, there's the L word. I'm not sure what the conception or the original intention was. They were pretty and they were saucy and they were sexual and they had good clothes and, and all that stuff is positive in a certain way. But I wouldn't say that there was, a real depiction of interior life to any three-dimensional degree. And
so it's not that it has been lesbians have been depicted badly, just not much depicted.
Yeah. I mean, there was that, and that was a certain style of, lesbian fantasia or whatever. And
there's a title.
I don't know
you could make lesbian fantasia.
I know, right?
Film.
I'm going to do a cartoon for Disney next.
So Annette Bening in this movie, Annette Bening and Julianne Moore play Nick and Jules, who are this couple at the center. They had children 15, 18 years ago using an anonymous sperm donor, which is pretty common. But But the uncommon thing here is having the donor then become kind of part of the family many years later. Was this notion, this basic concept, pure fictional conceit, or did you know some version of this in real life?
You know, as it happened, I was with my girlfriend and we wanted to have a family and trying to figure out, well, okay, what are we going to do here? And, you know, thought about doing it with a friend or doing it with an anonymous sperm donor. And that, for a variety of reasons, turned out to be the right thing for us. And then, you know, opening that door, you start asking a lot of questions and, you know, I became very kind of mono-focused in my life.
Yeah. And the particular – this awkwardness between these children and their father is so interesting because, of course, that exists. And it really hasn't existed in this way until now. So you really – it was virgin territory.
Yeah. And it was interesting as we screened the film in San Francisco and I had one guy in the audience – you know, kind of his hand went up right after and he was like, oh, my God, it's so exciting to see this film. That was exactly how it happened for me. I met, you know, my biological daughter. I was a sperm donor and she tracked me down and that was exactly like our first meeting and blah, 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 which was comforting to me to know that
since
we
you
sort
made
of
it up.
since I made it up, you know.
Mark Ruffalo plays Paul, who is this lovable biological dad, and then his arrival makes the whole family start sort of losing its established balance, partly because these children start to really bond with him. I want to play a clip where the daughter, Joni, is hanging out with Paul.
Ugh, ignore.
Who's that?
My mom, Nick. She's driving me crazy.
Yeah, what's she doing?
She's treating me like I'm 12. It's like she doesn't want to admit that I'm an adult.
Well, it's your mom. That's her job.
What? Does she mother me to death? That's not her job.
If you want things to be different, you gotta do that, make that happen yourself. It's your job.
Yeah.
You like peppers?
Yeah. Thanks.
That was a clip from the new movie, The Kids Are All Right. Paul, the father, is this almost too good to be true guy. He's this total stud, really sweet to the children, rides a motorcycle, but has a locavore restaurant and an organic garden that he farms himself. When the Julianne Moore character, Jules, has her dalliance with him, we really get to the heart of this story, which is that disruption of this middle-aged relationship. Did you always know that that was going to be the engine driving this story?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it, from the very beginning, I had a kind of a sketch of a plot, which was, you know, here's this family, here's this question that's kind of the elephant in the room. And this plot point happens where the mom, you know, one of the moms decides to work out her midlife crisis with this person who's absolutely the wrong person to be working that out with. It really opened up so many questions to have the film structured that way.
Well, and one of the things that's great about the film is that there's not lots and lots of talk, like politicized conversation of, well, this is a betrayal of our sisterhood or any of that stuff.
Oh, my God. That was like the last thing we wanted to do. I think for Stuart and I, we just felt like that wasn't interesting to us, you know, and that by and large isn't where the culture really is anymore. And, you know, sexuality is kind of on a continuum and
– which a lot of your movies have been about that flux and continuum of sexuality.
Yeah. I mean, and I certainly, you know that for some people it's not on a continuum at all. You know, they're resolutely this or that.
Right. And speaking of subverting expectations, there's this very interesting and funny scene in the movie where we see these two women, Jules and Nick, watching gay male porn. Which certainly challenges people's stereotypes of lesbians, I think, and of women, for that matter. What? Where did that come from?
You know, I just have my ear to the ground, and I just know that that's something that lesbians watch sometimes. Not all, for sure, but I've heard that. And Stuart really argued vehemently for us to have that and keep that in the film.
Good choice.
At first, I was like, oh, it's too racy. It's too, you know, bizarre. Nobody's going to be able to relate to that. And then the more I thought about it, I'm like, you know what, people, you never know what somebody's going to pull out of their bag of tricks. And that's what's fun. And that's what's fun about going to movies. You know, you get to learn things about human nature.
Well, I hope people go see this because it's a really terrific film.
I appreciate your support. Thanks.
My conversation with Lisa Cholodenko from last summer when The Kids Are All Right was about to be released. It's now out on DVD, and it was nominated for Oscars this week. We all spend literally years of our lives in our kitchens. But have you ever really stopped to think why the modern kitchen looks the way it does? The Museum of Modern Art in New York recently acquired the mother of all modern kitchens, including yours, unless you're Amish. The prototype was developed in Germany, and it's known as the Frankfurt Kitchen.
Almost everything we know about kitchens today comes from the Frankfurt Kitchen.
Lynn Peterson designs kitchens, and today in Design for the Real World, she traces the evolution of what she calls the most important room in the house.
If you don't eat, you don't live. So first man had a kitchen. Then maybe man had a bathroom. Well, the kitchen was the first room in the house, and for a long time it was the only room. And pieces of things were added as they evolved. They were just a room that over several decades got this added, got that added. There was no design. There was no intent for the purpose. They were very random. You would have either a fireplace with a pot hanging from some sort of a rack, or later they would just stick an oven in there. The sinks were freestanding and with no work surface or drainage board or anything like that. They just worked on a big work table in the middle of the room. It was a schlep. You were schlepping from point A to point B to point C, carrying everything with you. In 1926, that all changed with the Frankfurt Kitchen. It was the first working class discreet kitchen. Germany experienced a population explosion, and there was a housing crisis. And so Marguerite Schutlotsky was an Austrian architect. Wouldn't you know, it would be a woman. No surprise there. She was one of the first female architects in Austria altogether, and she was very involved in the anti-Nazi resistance. The reason German furniture is so heavy is the Germans don't like you to move anything. They want the furniture to stay where the furniture is. And so she didn't prescribe to that. One of her projects that she was involved in was design an incredibly cheap and small kitchen. And also for public housing. And then she was charged with making it incredible, making it awesome. She brought in so many things, both big and small. Not just the ergonomic or the layout or the floor plan, but so many design elements that set the trends for the 20th century. The stainless steel sink. Instead of a porcelain, the double stainless steel sink, glass-doored cabinets. I mean, she was the first one to do fitted cabinets. She did her range, yes, an integrated range. Range is when you have the cooktop and the oven or stove together. She put all of her storage to the right facing of her sink, making the assumption that most people are right-handed. She's the first one to rationalize where and how we store things. I think it was haphazard and random before that you just put in a chest of drawers or a bureau or an open shelving unit or a pie rack. She was the first one that put cutlery in the cutlery drawer, spices in the spice drawer. Even as recently as 1940, the average woman spent over 5 hours a day in the kitchen. Schutlotsky's objective was very much to optimize workflow, and she did time motion studies to determine how long each step of the process took. And I think that was an incredible gift to the cook of the family, that they would minimize the amount of wasted motion we had to use in a kitchen. She wanted it to be easy for us. Now we have microwaves. So it's fun to imagine how she would have incorporated them. And I can almost look at her kitchen and say where she would have put things. You know, the microwave would have been the far right corner from the sink. If you're wondering what your oversized kitchen has to do with the Frankfurt kitchen, if you're standing at your kitchen sink and you're reaching for your cutlery drawer, it's exactly where Schutlotsky would have placed it. If you have a stainless steel sink, you're in a Schutlotsky kitchen. If you have wood cabinets, you're in glass doors, you're in one whether you know it or not. You are.
Designer Lynn Peterson. You can see images of the original Frankfurt kitchen at studio360.org. And the real thing is installed at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City until March. Our story was produced by Britta Conroy Randall. Coming up, the secret ingredient to making a great artist.
My mother started taking me to museums very early and introducing me as Richard the Artist.
Richard Serra and other famous artists remember their creative baby steps. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This year, we're celebrating Studio 360's first decade on the air. And as part of the festivities, we and HarperCollins are publishing the first Studio 360 book. It's drawn from the thousands of conversations I've had on the show about creativity and art and life over the last 10 years. It's called Spark, How Creativity Works. Spark was written by Julie Burstein, the executive producer of Studio 360 for many years. She pored over our archives to find the stories for the book. And she is here with me now. Julie, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
So Spark is not just, as you know better than anyone, a collection of transcripts of interviews. It really can be read as a guidebook, a kind of collection of case studies about how creative people are made. One of the chapters is about childhood, something I ask almost every guest in here about. Do most of these successful, super creative people you find know from a very young age that they wanted to do creative work for a living?
You know, when I was looking at the interviews and listening to them, I found that there were two categories. There were some people who knew almost from birth that they were going to be artists, and others who had these accidental moments in childhood that percolated through their work and really led them to the path of being a writer or a filmmaker. One of the people who's in the former category who found out that he was going to be an artist very early is the great sculptor Richard Serra. And I say found out because I'm not sure he knew, but his mother knew that he was going to be a sculptor very, very early. This is what he had to say.
I don't know if you know anything about Jewish mothers, but they're very important. And she was very, very insistent right away that I think in the third grade I had a teacher who pulled my mother into class, and they had all of my drawings up around the room, circled the periphery of the room. And she called my mother in and pointed it out, and she said, you should start taking this child to museums and to encourage what he's already doing. And so my mother totally got on to the program and started taking me to museums very early and introducing me as Richard the Artist.
She also introduced her other son as the lawyer, and he did become a very famous lawyer.
So in addition to stage mothers, there are gallery mothers,
I guess. And lawyer mothers, too, I guess.
Another artist, one of Richard Serra's contemporaries, in fact, is Chuck Close, who also thought of himself as an artist when he was a little kid, but he struggled with what we now call a learning disability.
Although in the 40s and 50s, nobody knew from learning disabilities, I was just dumb.
And what Chuck Close says after this is that the way that he learned to make art kind of made use of his learning disability. He was dyslexic. He also couldn't understand the whole, so he had to really focus on parts. He also had face blindness, which is interesting because most of his work is portraiture.
No, I remember when he was in here and I was talking to him, and I'd met him before. I've met him many times. Each time, it's a reintroduction.
Because absolutely.
He doesn't recognize you.
Yeah, and the way that he memorized his family's faces was by painting them. He also said, though, as a kid, art was really a way for him to connect to other people because he couldn't do it through school.
I think I learned early on that since I also wasn't athletic and I couldn't run or catch a ball or throw a ball, that I needed to do something to keep people around me. So I began doing magic acts and puppet shows, and I began to realize that one of the things that I could do that my friends couldn't do was draw. And I was lucky enough to have the support of my family and to feel like I had something to say, even though I didn't say it in the traditional way.
One of the things that surprised me as I listened to these interviews was that there's a theme not just of knowing that you're an artist at a very early age, but of this idea that the thing that is the most difficult for you actually leads you to your work. And the great novelist Richard Ford, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, he talked about having such a hard time reading as a kid because he was seriously dyslexic.
I was slow to learn to read and still to this day can't read silently much faster than I can read aloud. But there were a lot of benefits to being dyslexic for me, because when I finally did reconcile myself to how slow I was going to have to do it, then I think I came very slowly into an appreciation of all those qualities of language and of sentences that are not just the cognitive aspects of language, the syncopations, the sounds of words, what words look like, where paragraphs break, where lines break. I mean, I wasn't so badly dyslexic that I was disabled from reading. I just had to do it really slowly. And as I did, lingering on those sentences as I had to linger, I fell heir to language's other qualities, which I think has helped me write sentences.
That's such a great idea, that the very difficulty of reading sort of slowed him down and made him relish each bit of writing. And it's also, I think, a great point about creativity in general in all of our lives. It may be something that comes easy in a particular medium or business or whatever, but it also needs to present a certain challenge, or what's the fun?
Richard Ford also talked about something that I heard over and over as I listened to your conversations, which is there was something that happened that came up years later in his work. And for Ford, in his latest novel, The Lay of the Land, there's this moment when Frank Bascom, his main character, suddenly is remembering his mom running over the family cat. And that actually was something that happened to Richard Ford when he was 6 years old. He was at home by himself. He watched his mom back out of the driveway, right over their cat, and was left with the cat in its death throes.
And I picked the little cat up, and I ran next door where there was this old Civil War veteran. And I ran up to him, and I said, "Colonel something or other," I said, my cat's been run over." And he was, of course, addle-pated as could be. And he said to me, he said, "I think you've got a Persian there." He said, "But looks like something's wrong with it." I've known that story all my life. It's just, but I haven't ever thought that it would ever find its way into anything I wrote. I would sometimes tell it to people. Told it to people for decades. Suddenly, a moment comes in the middle of this book that it seemed to fit in perfectly, and there it was.
Well, that's certainly how, in my experience, writing works. Is you have this cupboard, this filled with stuff that you know that has happened, and you're never sure that you need that can in the back of the third shelf in the cupboard until you're doing something and it comes up. I also empathized greatly with Ford when he told me that story, because my mother also ran over and killed one of our cats. Yes, the so-called baby kitty at the time.
Oh.
But does this mean that, I hope we're not saying that absent some traumatic event or disability, people don't become creative?
Thank goodness there are also stories about wondrous things that happen in childhood. And I think the key thing is just keeping your eyes open to whatever happens. And for the filmmaker Mira Nair, she talks about a moment that happened. She was growing up in this small town in India, a provincial town where her father worked, and she and her brothers played in the streets all the time. And there was a moment that really changed her.
Traveling folk theater would come through the town, and I would go off and see this great battles of good and evil by two people in a school field with no props, but with a lot of, you know, passion and hashish as well. And it was just
passion and hashish.
Yeah, everyone was stoned out of their heads, and it was amazing. You know, the folk tales of Mahabharata and Ramayana, the two holy books, the epics that everything comes out of in India, they say. After seeing that jatra, the folk theater, I knew I wanted to get on, you know, and perform.
I think that that's so important. And again, if parents are thinking, I want to maximize my children's creativity, simply...
The violin lessons are not enough.
Are not enough. And you never know. Take them to the city you live near. Take them to the forest you live near. I mean, who knows where they might find something that'll change their lives.
For you, what was it like for you growing up, Kurt? Were you... did your mom say, here's my son, the writer, or...
No, she sort of did. And a key moment was when I was in third grade, I wrote an essay for Thanksgiving that was bogus, but it was for Thanksgiving.
That sounds like your later work, too, sometimes.
What, bogus?
maybe not bogus.
And it was about how the most important things are oxygen, freedom, and God. And already at eight, I had my doubts about God. So, but she thought this was wonderful and sent it to the local newspaper in Omaha, which published it with my picture. And really, it was all about kind of this egomaniacal revelation. What? I can write? It'll be published? Everyone will see it? Okay, this looks good.
And here we are.
And here we are. Julie, this is a rich, rich trove, this book, Spark, and I can't wait to talk to you more next week about it. Thanks.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
And we'd also love to get everybody involved in this conversation, whether you've been listening to Studio 360 for 10 years or just started this week. Please weigh in here. What was the moment in childhood that made you who you are? Tell us about it at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can hear more from the interviews you heard bits of today, and you can read an excerpt from our Studio 360 book, Spark, How Creativity Works. And, of course, you can find out how to get a copy of Spark. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Dori Carr Harris,
Sarah Dalia,
Mary Du.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the poet Kevin Young takes on slavery, Black History Month, and Steven Spielberg. I'll talk with him about his new book on the Amistad Rebellion. And we'll look back at 10 years of Studio 360 to unlock the spark of being a great artist. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.